You're listening to Voices of Public Intellectuals with Lonnie Guinier.
Now, what does this have to do with power over versus power with? Well, many of my colleagues suggested that we just had to fix the canary, toughen up the canary, make the canary more like the men. Law is about competition. Competition is about domination. Competition is about winning. Competition is about control. The women needed to learn how to be men. On the other hand, many of my colleagues in the academy are discovering that lawyers and the model of lawyering as the gladiator, as the rugged adversary who goes into court and fights for his or her client is an outdated notion of lawyering. Litigation is too expensive. Most lawyers do not practice in front of a court. And indeed, those who do practice, I was a litigator for over 10 years. There was never a time when the court, the judges before whom I was making an argument, knew more about my case than I did. So the model of the sage on the stage dominating the students was not, in fact, a true or accurate portrayal of the relationship between the lawyer and the judge. So that the women who were trying to build a learning community actually had a powerful insight about what lawyers could be learning to do, learning how to solve problems by listening to what others have to say, building on those contributions, trying to say something that is relevant, that moves the discussion forward. Now, how do you have a power with model coexisting in a power over society? It is a challenge, but I think it is a challenge well worth exploring. Short term, it may be true that women need to repopulate the hierarchy. One of my colleagues calls it climbing backwards up the cheese grater. Right? Getting up to the top to be in a position then to change the rules. But I want to suggest an alternative model. I want to suggest that whatever women do, it has to be with allies, and I would hope it has some vision of power with in it, so that it is not simply replacing whoever is presently at the top of the hierarchy with new people whose goal it is to replicate that hierarchy, but beginning to imagine a new shape. If the hierarchy is a pyramid or a triangle, an upright triangle, and as you get higher and higher, there are fewer and fewer people. The shape that I imagine power with embodied in is an oval. And in the oval, the top and the bottom look very much the same. But most of the people in the oval are in the middle. And in this oval, rather than seeing power as moving upwards to the top of the hierarchy, power circulates. It rotates throughout the oval. That's my model of power with. Now, how do you not just envision this, but then try to implement it? And the challenge that I have found as a law professor is to allow my women students and my people of color, my students of color, to lead. That is, look for the canary, look for the group who feels left out, who feels unrepresented, who feels that they have less of a voice, who feels powerless in this power over hierarchical model. And see the problems that converge around that canary. See the way those problems are made visible because they are experienced by a group that is visible. And then use that observation to begin to rethink the atmosphere in the minds, at least within your own classroom. And that is what I have tried to do. So when my students have come to me and said they want to do something different in a seminar, I have essentially deferred to their power. My goal is not to put them in charge, to go sit in the back of the room so they can sit in the front of the room and become sages on the stage, but to enable them to experiment, to create role plays and simulations that identify the problems that they are concerned about, and then encourage them to situate those problems both in a theoretical perspective and a practical, grounded framework. And what I have found that is so amazing about changing the dynamics, essentially ceding my power as the authority figure and instead empowering all of these students, is that it's fun. The students work harder in these classes, even when they're ungraded, than in their traditional Socratic classes. They spend hours trying to figure out ways to present the material to their classmates. They generate lots of energy and enthusiasm. And what is most compelling is that years later, they come up to me and they say, "Remember that class we did on?" I have never had a student in a traditional Socratic class come up to me years later and say, "Oh, remember that class we did on?" In fact, my experience with students is that the only time they remember an experience in a Socratic class is the experience of humiliation. So, this is not to say that my laboratories of power with will take over, right? That these little ovals will somehow now subsume the hierarchy. But I imagine them as both situated inside the hierarchy and perhaps as laboratories of experimentation, as laboratories of democracy, that they can become inspirational examples for other people to follow. And indeed, I've had colleagues come up to me and say, "Well, you know, Lonnie, I've heard about some of what you've done, and I tried it. And it was really exciting." And so part of the way in which we can introduce ideas of power with, not to completely eliminate the notion of power over, but as I said at the beginning, to coexist, to introduce the idea that we can collaborate in order to innovate so that we can enthusiastically come up with new ways of solving old problems. We can do that both inside the hierarchy, outside in the shadow of the hierarchy, and then imagine this oval overlapping points of the hierarchy in which it creates a little bit of pressure on the hierarchy, on the triangle, on the pyramid, to shift, to destabilize, to transform. So the idea of power with is the idea of tracking the experience of the canary, tracking the experience of those who've been left out, understanding the perspective of the losers, and trying then to tell a different story. Thank you very much.
Well, Professor Guinier has agreed to answer your questions, so I call on you to begin the conversation.
Going back to the game of the golf ball on the spoon and thinking of your mother's question, who invented the rules, I was thinking about how our government was set up, and it was set up by the founding fathers, not the founding mothers. And I think originally it was set up to be not quite an oval, but with our three branches of government and balance each other out. But I think that it, in reality, functions as more of the hierarchical pyramid. And I'm wondering if you've thought about realistic implementations of the oval sort of laboratories and how that comes into our working government and not it just being, you know, I used to always think, oh, it's great, there's so many more women in Congress and there's, you know, people of color in the Senate now. And is that really just the women becoming the men, like in the game?
I think that focusing on the rules, on the structure, is very important. Mm-hmm. We borrowed our notions of representative democracy from Great Britain, where democracy was thought of as an improvement over monarchy. And the idea was to give power to the people rather than to the king. There was not, however, enough thought, in my view, to how you distribute power among the people. Indeed, what happened instead is that we transferred power from a monarchy to an elite, right? When this country was founded, women could not vote, black people could not vote, even white men without property could not vote. So the assumption was that not all of the people should rule, only those who were appropriately invested in the status quo should be given the power over others. So part of the challenge over the past 200 years has been expanding that notion of democracy by expanding the franchise. That is important, but it's not enough. I've been thinking a lot about this. Why have we stopped rethinking the rules? Why is politics one of the few places where the American notion of entrepreneurial innovation, changing technology, has not been introduced? We are still very much focused on winner-take-all single-member districts, which we inherited from the British, meaning a single individual somehow is determined fit to represent all of the people who happen to live in a particular unit called a district. It's not even a neighborhood, it's called a district. It's a fiction that is created by incumbents who draw districts looking for voters who will keep them in office. So the voters don't choose their elected representatives, the elected representatives choose the voters. This has not been lost on the voters who have stopped voting. Part of the problem with this set of assumptions is that when you do go to vote, and if you vote for a loser, you are nevertheless considered to be represented by the person you voted against. Now, how does the person that you voted against represent you? Well, only in the virtual sense that that person represents the land on which you live, right? So it is not people who are being represented, it's districts that are being represented. You don't even have to vote and you are considered represented. Now, we justify this by a little notion of virtual representation. That is, well, you may not like the person who's elected to represent your district, but we're sure you can find somebody somewhere who thinks the way you do, and then that can become your representative, right? You can't vote for them, but you can certainly send them money. Now, this is the ultimate hierarchy with a pyramid of a single individual standing in for the whole. In literary terms, it's called synecdoche. It is the idea of the part for the whole. And the challenge is to begin to rethink democracy so that we have the whole for the whole. If we have a part standing in for the whole, it should be a part that is accountable to the whole, that is elected by some portion of the whole that is sympathetic with that part. So I have urged us to consider ideas of proportional representation, party list systems that are used in Cambridge in terms of the single transferable vote, but could be expanded the way they vote in South Africa, for example, once they went to all race elections. Rather than voting for an individual, you vote for a political party. And the political party only gets as much power in the National Assembly, in the National Legislature, as a percentage of the vote total. So the ANC got 64.5% of the votes. They got 64.5% of the seats. The Inkatha Freedom Party got 11% of the votes. They got 11% of the seats. The White Afrikaners got 70% of the votes. They got 17% of the seats. Now, part of what happens, and this you mentioned seeing women in Congress, in Europe, where they use proportional representation, where they use party list systems, where they were not former colonies of Great Britain, you have many more women in the national legislature than you do have here in the United States. I mean, 30-40% of the national legislature in many European countries is composed of women, in part because the parties list women as their candidates, and if enough people vote for that particular party, those women then become elected. It's a system that has faults, but it's a system that opens up opportunity to rotation in office where you have more of the oval, that is, where more of the people are in the middle, and the focus is on rotating power in the middle rather than trying to climb backwards up the cheese grater to get to the top of the hierarchy. So I do think it's time to rethink the structure of winner-take-all, single-member districts designed by incumbents to stay in office.
Next question.
I'm interested
and
in
we'll
the...
have just one more after this question.
In the magical realism, or how to maintain faith and optimism that the oval can expand. I don't know if ovals can ripple, but in looking at one example of, I think, power with and women creating power in another country in a more academic setting that I did, and in my current work life where I work in an academic institution and I'm in that sort of middle rung where I can do ovals and the people above me can create atmospheres that make, how do we maintain optimism and how do we get, have some faith that really the people in power, I mean, I've always believed and had faith that sort of the right would prevail and that people would see and that people who are in power and are in a position to where they think they really want to maintain power over can really benefit from power with. But I don't see that and don't fight to maintain the optimism of that happening. So just your thoughts on that.
I have had the privilege of working with people in successful efforts, I believe, to change pieces of the world around us, but more important, to change ourselves, to create lasting ties that continue to energize us throughout our lives. And let me just give you a really quick story, not of one in which I was a participant, but in which I've been inspired. And this is the story of Reverend Nelson Johnson, who's a black minister in Greensboro, North Carolina, who got involved with the Kmart workers when the workers were challenging the fact that a Kmart distribution plant in Greensboro, North Carolina, was paying its workers $5.65 an hour less than workers at comparable plants. And the argument was the reason Kmart was paying its workers less is that 65% of its workforce was black. The original source of complaint was the black workers who went to their union and tried to articulate this as a labor management grievance. Nelson Johnson, a minister, and a group of black ministers reframed the debate. They got involved after the workers were despairing that nothing was changing, and they reframed the debate as a debate over sustainable community in Greensboro. They argued, how can this corporation come into Greensboro and pay all of its workers less than a living wage? This adversely affects everyone in Greensboro because the workers don't have the money to buy food, to put their kids in school because they don't have money to buy clothes, to outfit their children to go to school. They can't pay their rent. And all of this then creates a ripple effect that affects everyone adversely. He went and prayed in front of the Kmart distribution plant, and he and the other black workers got arrested. This then generated a lot of interest. The governor's aide came down and got arrested. A local professor at Guilford College and his students got arrested. And there was a lot of energy around this particular mobilization, at which point Kmart sued only the black workers and the black ministers, even though there were many other people now involved in this effort. At that point, Reverend Johnson again reframed the debate. He went to the white workers who had been now actively involved in this effort, and he said, "You're part of this effort. How come you weren't sued?" And they said, "You're right. We're part of this effort. How come we weren't sued?" And so they held a press conference in which the white workers demanded to know why they weren't sued, because they are part of this effort. Meanwhile, they settled the case. This is an example to me of why it's important to have faith. Not faith that miracles will happen, but faith that if we continue to work collectively, reframing the issue so it's not about competing hierarchies of oppression, but it's about identifying a vision of justice that we can all move to and build toward, that we can work together successfully over time, and we will experience little victories.
I'd like to pick up on an earlier thread. You spoke about, you spoke several times throughout the evening about a different model of lawyering and what might be successful. I personally have been involved over the years in quite a few employment discrimination cases, in winning upgrades in pay for the women teachers in Massachusetts and other groups. And I have also had the experience that you described, which is if you go back 10 years later, it's sort of all gone back and you didn't even notice it. And in fact, I don't spend my time doing those kinds of cases anymore. So I would really like to hear you speak a little bit more about this different notion of what it means to be a lawyer and to try to reframe issues and not just go in and try to win a battle for somebody. I think that a lot of very idealistic people think that if they gain these skills, they're going to get on a white horse and they're going to win battles for people. And I think you know very deeply and can speak to us well about the sense in which you might have a different sense of mission.
Well, that's a very big question that I could give a very long answer to, but I'll try instead to give you what I think of as a compelling image of a different kind of lawyering. And this is an image from Gary Bellow, who at the time was representing a group of people. He was working, I believe, with California Rural Legal Assistance. And he was representing a group of migrant farm workers who were complaining that the quality of the water in their community was very, very low. And they were trying to figure out how to get the local water district to take them seriously. Now, the traditional notion of lawyering might be, well, you go and you hire an expert who takes water samples and measures the samples that are in the Mexican American community or among the farm workers, and then measures the samples in other areas and comes to the Water District Commission and presents the statistical evidence filled with charts, et cetera, to make a compelling case. That is, the lawyer and the other skilled expert mobilize resources on behalf of their clients. Instead, what Gary Bellow did is he had each of his clients fill a jug with water. And every day they put more water into the jug. And after 30 days, all of his clients came to the commission meeting with their jugs of water and put them on the hearing table. That created a compelling visual picture of these cloudy, dirty jugs of water. But it also empowered the clients to begin to understand that they had a role in articulating their own condition and working with the lawyer to bring their condition to the attention of the commissioners. So that this was not a situation in which the lawyer could litigate a case, win the case, and then leave, and then worry 10 years later what had happened. This was an example of really empowering the community to learn to exercise its own power. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Voices of Public Intellectuals, programming from the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study. The Institute invites your comments on the series, Feminisms and the Practice of Democracy, via their website at www.radcliffe.edu/feminisms. The producer for this series is Laura Roscos, director of the Graduate Consortium in Women's Studies. Thank you for joining us.